welcome once more into the Radiopedia reading room, where books line our shelves, but we don't read them because we're too busy reading x-rays and CTs and MRIs. My name is Andrew Dixon, and joining me, looking suitably desiccated and fissured, it's my co-host Frank Gaylard.
Oh, I have such a bad case of man flu, Dixon.
Oh, I really feel
completely rubbish. But in fact, I'd lost most of my voice over the weekend. So my voice is back, but apologies if I do sound a bit croaky.
Perfect opportunity for you to do your Chris Hemsworth impersonation. The whole episode.
I'm no more capable of impersonating him vocally than I am of doing so physically.
But hold on, let me close my eyes, right? So if I close my eyes and I can't see your weathered face and you say something like, "Where's my hammer?" and I'll be the judge.
I'm not playing this game, Dixon.
Oh, you're no fun, Gaylor. I'm still going to call you Thor for the rest of the episode today, though. So today's main segment, Thor, is the degenerative spine. So it's a panel discussion that I hosted at Radiopedia 2023 with neuroradiologist Wendy Gibbs from the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, and also with friend of the podcast, MSK radiologist Matt Skalski.
Oh, excellent. Getting better at spine imaging is actually on my to-do list of things to look at during my upcoming sabbatical. So this is timely.
Excellent. And get better at tennis, those kind of things. That's what sabbaticals are usually for.
What was that version of tennis you were telling me about the other day?
Pickleball. I reckon we're going to go and play a game of pickleball and we'll report back on the podcast. It's supposed to be all the rage. And there's one just down the road from us. So.
Smaller court, bigger rackets. That sounds good.
Yeah, smaller court. So less running around, but still some skill, I hope, and a bit of fun. Now, there is actually a quick promotional reason why I picked this panel discussion for this week's episode, Gaylord, and that's because Matt Skalski and I have just released a new x-ray interpretation course on Radiopedia all about lumbar spine x-ray interpretation. I say I, but really it was all Matt. I just provide some audio commentary and some extra quizzes and things.
Oh, excellent. I'm always blown away by the thoroughness of Matt's understanding of the topics that he teaches. I also reckon that the fact that he spends so much time creating those amazing illustrations has meant that he sort of knows a lot about what the bones really look like. Like, he's paid a lot of attention, and that really comes out in the way that he teaches.
He doesn't just know osteophytes. He is osteophyte.
That's right.
But it is a fantastic course, though. I learned so much when I was helping him to put it together. And of course, it comes with Italian accent, AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits, which is good. And which, by the way, we've added to a whole bunch of our existing updated x-ray interpretation courses, including the very popular bone lesions learning pathway that Matt and I made a year or so ago.
Yes, we're really getting there with the CME side of things. And just so folk know, we're actually working towards accrediting a substantial subset of our online general Radiopedia articles too, so that you'll be able to claim points for reading them online as part of your normal day-to-day work. That's in progress in the nearish future, which probably means late this year, but getting there.
But when you're like a god like you and you're eternal, what's a year? All right, I reckon it's time to jump into the main segment. So this panel took place immediately after Wendy had just delivered a lecture entitled Degenerative and Postoperative Spine, and Matt a lecture titled Lumbar X-ray Interpretation, Disc Degeneration and Spondylolisthesis. So nicely paired. Wendy's lecture can be found in the Radiopedia lecture collection over on our website. It's free for all access pass holders and in 125 low and middle income countries. This episode is so promotional. And Matt's lecture is now part of our x-ray interpretation course. That's what I spoke about before.
You really are doubling down on the promotion side of things, Dixon. You got any merch that you want to plug while we're at it?
I've just made a series of Frank Gaylord as Thor figurines. I'm about to drop ship those around the world. Perfect timing.
Excellent.
All right, well, let's listen into the main segment now. So it's Wendy Gibbs, Matt Skalski, and me as the hosts, and then Thor himself will be back for a chat in the outro. And I'm actually very excited to see if Gaylord tells the same spine MRI story that he's told three times already on the podcast. Can't wait. Joining me now are the two speakers we've just watched. So it's Matt Skalski and Wendy Gibbs. Thank you for those fantastic lectures.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here, Andrew.
They were actually very nicely paired, those two lectures. So one kind of looking at the x-rays and one more focused on the CT and the MRI. Matt, your lumbar spine x-ray interpretation skills, they're ridiculously good.
Oh, thank you.
Makes my knowledge in the area look quite shameful, to be honest. And the illustrations, perfect.
Took me a little while, but I think it was worth it.
Andrew, I don't know if you know, that's how I learned about cervical x-rays was from Matt, because we did a project together for RSNA that Matt did it all, of course, and taught me everything.
So. Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's in radiographics now if anyone wants to look at it.
We also put together a learning pathway for Radiopedia on it, again, where Matt basically just schooled me on how to interpret the cervical spine x-ray. Now, we're actually buttering you up here, Matt, because with those compliments, because in this panel discussion, I actually want to focus almost entirely on Wendy's lecture, if that's all right. So we're going to be focusing on degenerative disease and canal stenosis. Good, good, lucky. I didn't want you, suddenly you were just going to slam your camera down and leave the interview.
See you later.
So Wendy, fantastic lecture. Initially, you spoke about the role of spine imaging and that having an appreciation for the, you know, those background, high prevalence, asymptomatic, age-related findings, how important that is when you're considering how to formulate your report. Do you have any tips for how to word these types of findings in our reports so that we don't assign clinical significance to things that isn't really warranted?
Yeah, that's the question of the day. That is really hard to do because it stresses the importance that we need to know a little bit of history. So whether you have a pain diagram with your study somehow, or know just a little bit of history from the clinician, I think that's vital because otherwise we're doing it blind. And everybody's got, after a certain age, all these changes. And most of them, the vast majority, have no significance. But these days when the patients are seeing their reports, you know, I had a surgeon friend tell me this. She's like, you said all these things about every level. And the patients come to me like, why didn't you talk about this to me? Why aren't you treating this? So it is very difficult. So, you know, the more you learn about it, if you can talk to your surgeons, I know that's not possible everywhere, talk to the ordering doctors, and the more you read and know, you can kind of maybe guess which level is going to be the problem, the more you know. But really, if I see one thing that I think is going to be it, based on maybe even a limited history, I'll only talk about that. I don't ever talk about everything I see for that reason. But I know everybody's got different situations and it's tough.
I did something similar, you know, the body of the report, I really do, you know, go through every level and every finding essentially that I see, but don't attribute any kind of clinical significance to them. And then in the conclusion of the report, it's very much only picking out things that they gave me the history for that would correlate with potential source for that radiculopathy or whatever. Yeah. Matt, you must deal with a lot of dubious findings in your x-ray interpretation as well. What kind of words do you use in your reports to communicate those?
Yeah, I mean, I often don't have a great history, as most people have to deal with. And so I'll often, you know, just say, you know, it may cause this if there's associated clinical symptoms. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll even say what those symptoms are, because although I know that the referrer knows what symptoms to look for, I'm always thinking with an eye to the patient reading it. And, you know, there's always an odd chance that the clinician doesn't know, depending on who they are. If the patient's asking their doctor questions like, why aren't we treating this? You know, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. Like, the surgeon might not want their time wasted, but, you know, empowers patients to really take charge of their healthcare and kind of figure out what might be important that might be being missed, you know, based on what you said. So I always err on adding a little bit more, which I know isn't everyone's preference, and maybe it causes some people a little bit of a headache. But I think it's okay to just, you know, say, you know, if there's symptoms, and maybe state what symptoms you might be concerned about and hope the patient actually does read it and kind of takes charge of their own healthcare.
Now, Wendy, I was very glad to hear that you're a believer in the role of spine surgery for canal stenosis, because you do hear a lot of people, you know, never let a surgeon near your back, right? That's the last thing you want to do. It was refreshing, really, to hear that you're a believer, and I have a lot of great spine surgeons that I work with, and we get a lot of great outcomes. Planning the extent and type of surgery really seems quite important. And you mentioned that if you do too little surgery, you can get failed back. And if you have to do too much surgery, then you can get instability down the track. Can you kind of expand on that a little? What kind of things feed into a surgeon's decision-making process when choosing, you know, how many levels to operate over, for instance?
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's another, that's a tough question, because spine surgery is a huge topic. It's a huge field. And you think about all the different reasons you might have spine surgery, whether, you know, even the usual degen that we're talking about, is it stenosis? Is it going to be a foramen? Is it going to be radiculopathy? Is it for deformity? Is it for pediatric scoliosis? Everything there will fit into what they are doing. In addition to, does the patient have osteoporosis? Do they need to have longer, stronger constructs cement? young patients obviously would not have that problem. You know, there's so many things I think that go into it. And again, and I say the same answer I said to your last question, the more you talk to your surgeons and read their notes and even just read about spine surgery in general, you kind of get more of an idea. And I know radiology is also big, so we don't all have time for that. And it, for me, it's interesting. So that's why I try to read so much of it and try to learn it. I think that's vital though, to know the answer to your question. And also, you know, there's no agreement in spine surgery either. All those things, you know, you find just like we all do things differently, they all do things differently. And they move toward, they're trying to move toward standardization with AI and everything else too, and like predicting what the best surgery would be or who the best patient is. But just like every other field, all that is kind of still very individualistic, trying to move toward standardized but patient-centered care. So that was that kind of not an answer at all to your question, but it's the best answer I can give you that. So.
Well, every time I attend our spine meeting and I hear the discussions back and forward between the spine surgeons about how they would approach this problem, there's always more than one opinion in the room. And even after multiple years, I can't really predict what levels they're going to do and whether they're going to come from the front or the back, those kind of things. So, yeah.
And they change. We had a case where, you know, cervical spine, they used to go from the front to keep the posterior elements intact. You're talking about iatrogenic instability. That was in your question. Preserve the posterior element so you don't cause instability, lose all that support. But now there's kind of a trend to go from the back again, which, and today we saw a not so good of an outcome, even though it was probably the only shot the person had it. You know, it's not a bad outcome if it was their only chance and they were worse off before anyway. But the trends change so quickly too. So it's always growing and expanding, just like our own field. So anyway, sorry, I had to interject that at the end because that's a little bit more.
Yeah, that's fun.
Addressing what you had.
I want to skip to the post-op period now. So in that immediate post-op period, you often get a CT to kind of check the screw position, plates, you know, the intervertebral prostheses. And you mentioned that example of the lateral mass screw extending into the transverse frame and pushing on the vertebral artery. Unless it's causing clear vascular issues, the surgeons tend to not concerned by it too much. I do find it hard, actually, knowing how much importance to put on all these little screws in slightly odd positions that we see, like, you know, when it penetrates through the anterior cortex of the vertebral body, for instance. Do you have any tips for knowing which are the concerning kind of screws in the wrong spot to report? Or is it, again, another one of those areas where it's a little bit tricky?
It is, again, and it's, again, the same answer is that I'm learning. So every time I might call something and then my surgeon friend, you know, will text me and say, hey, Wendy, that screw is actually okay. You don't have to worry about that. So I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, it's going in the artery. What are you going to do? And I'm shocked by the answer that they wouldn't do anything about it. But things like the sacral screws, they don't worry about those. Even if they go way out, they expect bicortical purchase. Cervical spine, not as much. But same thing again, I learn every day by either hearing from my surgeons or asking my surgeons, because I don't ever want to put anything in there that's going to get them in trouble. Because medical legally, especially, I mean, here these days, it'd be terrible if there was a thing that was not a problem at all for the patient and I said it was a complication and somehow something bad happened to that surgeon. So I try to be very careful, talk to them if I can. And if I can't, I'll kind of describe it without, you know, saying this is a error, you know, or anything bad. Yeah. I try to describe it knowing they will read it and then I will call them and let them know and just say, you know, is this okay? This is this way. If you need to fix it, do it quick. I don't know. What about you, Matt? What do you have that?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. It's always good to ask them, you know, and if you can get a hold of them or any, get a hold of someone else, one of their colleagues, you know. And if it is a complication, you know, of course you might want to make sure it's documented, but yeah, I mean, certainly if you're not confident, you want to err on the side of caution and give a little room for them to discuss that with the patient and let them know that, you know, it's probably not a big deal, even though it's not ideal.
Yeah. I think it may be even a little bit easier with some things like if it, you know, cage is migrated into the canal or the frame and that, you know, you can call and, you know, that's not supposed to be there. But things like, yeah, some of the screws and some of the newer devices, we don't even know what they are or what they're supposed to look like. So I think it can be tough sometimes.
Yeah, it's true. Exactly. So moving on to, you mentioned the post-operative fluid collections inside that kind of laminectomy defect. They're quite common. And does the fluid there, I was wondering, does that always imply that it's a pseudomeningocele, or can that just be, you know, some seroma or something? And then related to that, you know, if you get asked, and I've been asked quite a few times, to percutaneously drain these fluid collections, is that okay, even if it is a pseudomeningocele, to be sticking a needle in and aspirating?
Yeah, that's, we get asked that all the time. So, and the answer is, oftentimes you don't know if it's a pseudomeningocele versus a seroma. So I, you know, if it's not clear, like I had one just the other day, it was clearly just a seroma. There was no connection. I could tell there was no connection to thecal sac on the, it was an MRI that they got. But a lot of times it's not clear. And even, or even on the MRI, it might look like a big connection to the thecal sac, but our resolution isn't quite good enough to know. So I always do a myelogram. That way I can measure, if there is a connection, I can measure it. If it's less than 4 millimeters, I might be able to treat it with aspiration and put blood and fibrin in there, treat it myself, because the surgeon to go in there is a huge deal. To go back in, you can imagine a patient would probably much rather have me, the needle, trying to do some stuff in there to fix it than the surgeon. I think you do need to do that extra step with myelogram to really know for sure in a lot of cases. But then if it is, you know, seroma, they, I'm told those are painful. I still have no idea why. I've looked that up a million times, but apparently having those seromas does cause the patient pain. And if nothing else, I'm sure it feels weird to have that big flexural mass in your back.
In terms of the longer-term complications after spinal surgery, you showed examples of arachnoiditis and looking for those clumped, you know, corticoquinar nerve roots or ones that are sitting peripherally and almost, you know, that empty thecal sac sign. And you mentioned that there's not really any treatment for it. You can't really do much about this complication once it develops, which makes me wonder, are there certain patients who are more at risk of developing arachnoiditis post-op and therefore patients who may avoid kind of surgery on, or is there no real predictable nature to it?
Yeah, and that is such a good question. I don't know the answer if some people are more at risk for getting it or not, because I imagine people who have more, can mount maybe more of an inflammatory response to the little blood or something might get it more, but I don't know how you would know that. But it's a great topic to look into and to research. I would be, now that you've asked that great question, I am going to look into it more because I want to know now. Yeah. But there are other, also different causes of it. You know, it could be blood from the surgery, but people, you know, people get subarachnoid hemorrhages all the time. Why don't they get it? People who, they say steroid injections, if they got steroid and thecal sac can cause it, you know, old infection can cause it. So it also kind of depends probably what is the inciting factor. Is a little blood, is it a lot of blood? Is it something else? So that makes it also a little bit difficult, I think, to study. But I know that the field of treating it is still, you know, very active investigation with, you know, pain pumps and stimulators and stuff like that. Medically, I don't know if there are any drugs they're using now.
So moving on to hardware complications. So for screw loosening, we're looking for around 2 millimeters of lucency around the screw as a sign it's become loose, or backing out of the screw, or sometimes, you know, actual fracture of the metal wear itself. And actually, Matt, this is something that potentially is easier to spot on the lumbar spine or cervical spine x-rays than it is on CT, in my experience, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, x-rays, you can see everything at a glance. And so when you can see everything at a glance, it's much easier to pick up on these things than, you know, looking through 1,000 images to try and find it. So, you know, there's a good role for x-rays, you know, CT better for most things. But when you need to see a global picture, x-rays are often, you know, the most valuable.
And even the scout films for the CT, often I still struggle to be able to define the metal wear very well on that. I still find a conventional x-ray much better. Wendy, have you got any tips on that?
Yeah, I agree with you both. I mean, I think x-rays also are easier to evaluate, and the scout on the CT is easier than the CT itself. And so it always surprises me when they order the CT to evaluate it, because I'm thinking, you know, I'd rather see an x-ray too.
The teaching point, I guess, is when you're assessing the post-op CT, you know, specifically look for metal wear complications, right? Scroll through and actually have a look and go, right, I want to make sure these rods are intact. I want to make sure all these screws are intact, because you don't get that nice overall view like you do on an x-ray. And it's quite easy. I've found quite easy to miss a metal wear fracture. I want to wrap up this panel discussion, Wendy, by just recapping on a few of the final pearls that I got out of your lecture. I've written them down here, so I'm just going to read through them, if that's all right. So the first one I've written here is adjacent segment degeneration. You said it usually occurs at the level directly above the fuse segment. It can occur below, but most commonly directly above. And you get loss of disc height, end plate osteophytes, but you really need to review prior images, right, to ensure that it's progressive and wasn't a pre-existing finding, right, before you can use this term of adjacent segment degeneration. And it needs to be symptomatic before you can call it disease, right? So adjacent segment degeneration, if you see progressive degenerative features at the level above the fixation, And then if it's symptomatic, you can call it adjacent segment disease. Does that sound all right?
Yeah. And that's all, again, I base that kind of on the surgical literature. I try to, everything I say, I try to base on what the way they think of it. So that's kind of what I've gotten from them and reading their papers. The thing about not calling it if it was there before, yeah, you don't want to blame their construct. Let people perpetuate that, you know, spine surgery is a bad thing. If it was there before, it's not really their fault.
Well, I had a spine surgeon come into the reading room yesterday and we were looking at some stenosis below his level of fixation. And it was all pre-existing. It was nothing to do with his surgery, but it was just kind of like starting to cause issues, unfortunately. The next thing I've written here is intervertebral disc grafts and lack of osseous fusion across the disc space after a year is considered pseudoarthrosis and indicates that there is continued movement through the level, which is not what you want, and that's a major cause of failed surgery. And then importantly, the osseous bridging needs to not just be within that prosthetic graft itself, but it needs to be anterior and posterior to the graft. And then at 6 months post-op, if you are seeing sclerosis of the end plate on CT or X-ray or continued edema of the end plate on MRI, then they can also be signs that osseous fusion is not going to occur. It's not happening. Is that correct?
I think all those are, yes, correct. The one part that I want to ask Matt real quick, if that's okay. So the in the graft, in front and behind the graft, that's the controversial part. Because I think, you know, different places say different things, and it's controversial in the spine surgery literature too. Matt, what do you think about that?
I mean, obviously the more bony architecture you have surrounding the construct, the better. And, you know, people didn't used to use these. They would just do only bony fusion. So, you know, that's good enough even without the hardware. So, yeah, I mean, I think it really is up to the surgeon to decide what they're happy with because it's their surgery. Our job is just to report what's there and they can kind of put that together with what their area of expertise is and kind of what they're happy with and what their expected outcomes are.
The final thing I've got written here is, again, with those disc prostheses, the grafts, 2 millimeters or so of subsidence into the end plate is generally okay. But any more than, you know, 3 millimeters or so, you really, you know, you're not adequately restoring the disc height, which is kind of what you're trying to do by having that in there. And so you're going to narrow the superior inferior height of the neural foramen and therefore predispose to maybe recurrent radiculopathy. That's all the ones I had written down here.
That's all. Remember those three things.
Well, Wendy, Matt, that's everything that I plan to chat about in this panel discussion, unless you guys have anything else you want to bring up at this point.
No, I think that was a great discussion. That's a lot of the key points there emphasized. I think people can take those last few things you said away. That's great. If they can get the rest of it, even better.
I was learning a lot of stuff from your lecture, Wendy.
Spine is fun.
But the post-op spine, I think, is tricky. And it is one of those areas where you are trying to, you don't necessarily know exactly what the surgeon's done or what their intent was when they did it. And therefore, in your report, it's quite difficult to report. It's quite difficult to know how much to make of things. So, and I think we've clarified that with a few things, but we've also uncovered in this discussion that it is an area that is tricky. And if you can just communicate more with your spine surgeons and with your referrers, that's probably the ultimate tip going forward in this area.
You can do it.
Yeah, thank you so much for both of your lectures. Thank you, Matt, for allowing me to only chat about Wendy's lecture today.
Yeah.
You have got 3 lectures at the conference, so you know, there's no lack of Matt Skalski around.
It's enough of me talking.
And thank you both for supporting Radiopedia as well. It means a lot to me.
Awesome.
Thank you to Wendy Gibbs and Matt Skalski for joining me there at last year's virtual conference. Oh, sticking with the blatant promotional theme for this episode, let me just say that Matt will be back for Radiopedia 2024 this July with a lecture entitled Musculoskeletal Calcifications, where he's going to give us a tour of all different calcifications and how to spot them and what they might mean. So I'm very much looking forward to that topic, actually. He'll probably end up recording about 2 hours of content that our team will then have to edit. So I'm not looking forward to that. But otherwise, I'm looking forward to the topic.
That is a machine. I think he should just start doing his normal day-to-day work on Twitch. He could become the first radiology streamer.
You joke, but he's actually talked to me about this before.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If it wasn't for the patient privacy concerns, he would have done it already. But you know what? If you took a set of anonymous Radiopedia DICOM cases and then streamed yourself reporting on those cases, people would probably love it.
Yeah, I remember going to a course literally decades ago by Stephen Pomerantz, who did that live on stage, reporting cases remotely from his practice. It was a bit, you know, Las Vegas gimmicky in some ways. But actually, it did an excellent job of just showing how you apply the things that he was talking about in real life. And it stuck with me all these years because I remember having a little bit of an epiphany while watching him do that. This was when I was still training, I think. And it was like, oh, you really can report some of these studies really quickly and really safely if you have a very precisely defined sort of systematic approach. And that's something that I've kept with spine particularly, where I can crank through routine spines super fast in that kind of stepwise fashion. And it was good to see it actually being done as opposed to just spoken about.
And Pomerantz was probably wearing one of those Britney Spears headset microphones as he did it.
Of course.
100% gimmick for sure. This reminds me, and this is very unrelated, of an idea that I had recently, nothing to do with the spine, but we will get back to the spine soon. But I was watching some chest x-ray videos on YouTube for some reason. There's ones with, you know, millions of views, and almost all of them are by non-radiologists, and you can tell, and they're terrible, but the people watching them don't know, right?
Yeah.
You know, learn chest x-ray in 10 minutes, and so they love it. It's like, oh, perfect, I'll watch that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I've also noticed these, have you seen those like expert reacts to type videos? So like, you know, conductor reacts to Bradley Cooper conducting Maestro or whatever. And so I'm very tempted to combine these two things and to do, you know, radiologist reacts to YouTube chest x-ray videos or something. And I'll pause the video and call out the utter nonsense that's being spewed out in those videos. I mean, I won't actually ever do this, but it's fun to think about.
I'm generally not much of a fan of the react to videos, mostly because so many of them are overtly the laziest form of so-called content creation. Did you see that, is it XQC, the streamer? I don't know. He's one of the biggest streamer teenage guys.
I have to take your word on that.
Anyway, he's getting sued for not reacting during a reaction video.
Right.
He was playing someone else's entire video. And I think the lawsuit, I'm not sure this is right, but I think it was about a 1 hour episode on the JFK assassination. And he played the whole thing. And for most of it, he's just staring at it. And at one point, he even goes to the bathroom and keeps playing. Gosh.
Is there a definition, though, of how much you need to punch up the video in order to make it your own?
Yeah, I think whatever definition there is, this did not qualify.
Certainly going to the toilet probably doesn't count.
Well, I mean, that is a reaction, I suppose. Ooh, this video has made my bladder full. I need to go. But anyway, I think in this instance, the idea of doing one of these react to chest x-ray interpretation could be fun, Dixon. I'll let you do that one.
It's not a super efficient way of teaching, though, is it? But in some ways, the algorithm on YouTube and social media is actually biased against nuanced teaching anyway.
Absolutely. You could do it as a lecture for R25, where you teach a topic by reacting to a selection of terrible videos.
Yeah. At least that way it's not out in the public so much. Anyway, we should get back to the degenerative spine, which is the topic for this episode. Did you have something you wanted to bring up related to that?
Yes, quite a bit actually. One of the most important parts of the talk, which is something I think we keep coming back to on this show because I think it is really important, is that we as radiologists should really welcome the opportunity to interpret findings in clinical context and integrate what we see into what's happening to the patient rather than just describing findings. That's not just so that we're, you know, adding value, but also from a purely selfish point of view, it's the thing that'll make it harder for us to be replaced by offshore or AI, etc. And so I'm 100% on board with talking about the symptomatic level in the conclusion and that's all. And I often say things like, you know, L4-5 disc extrusion compressing the L5 nerve root accounts for the patient's sciatica or whatever, if that context has been given, because I think that's really helpful. Depending on who my referrer is, I do actually go a step further and include a note at the end of the report with the normal incidence of various degenerative findings in asymptomatic individuals. I'm pretty sure I mentioned this one before.
Yeah.
But maybe we should include those templates in the show notes for anyone who's interested, because they are really useful and I have received good feedback about that.
Yeah, we'll whack those in the show notes for the third time. You definitely have spoken about this. two or three times, but I've accepted that stopping an old man from repeating himself, even if he is a Norse god, is generally unachievable.
Speaking as an old man, you know, I've got
and a Norse god, yeah.
And a Norse god. I've got a milestone birthday coming up, right, Dixon?
Yeah. 60, is it?
Beep you. Anyway, other than that, I did like the pushback against the idea of never let a surgeon near your spine, because you do hear that a lot of the time. And although you definitely see a lot of poor outcomes out there, generally patients do great, at least compared to how they would do if they didn't have any surgery at all. I mean, if you have osteophytes pinching your nerve or, you know, tight canal stenosis due to facet joint degenerative change, what exactly do you think is going to happen if you don't have surgery? They're not just going to regress. They're not magically going to disappear if you wave a crystal over your back or have a turmeric enema or something.
Don't dismiss the power of an enema, Galen. But yeah, there are a portion of surgeries that are perhaps unnecessary or done too early. And I think that skews people's views. But as Wendy points out in her lecture, there are plenty of times and settings where surgery really is the best option. I also think because post-op imaging is hard for us as radiologists to interpret, that's another reason why we generally are biased against it, because it's like, oh, there's too much artifact getting in the way of my report. I hate surgery, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is at the top of my list of type of scans that I don't like to interpret. But one more thing that I think did come up in that talk is that once you've done your radiology training and spent a few years maturing sort of as a radiologist, I think
quite,
you actually
get...
Quite a few years.
You and Pomerantz.
Wow, you're really kicking me when I'm down. Anyway, I think you actually get quite a lot more out of your study or learning by looking at non-radiology content rather than just reading more and more about radiology. And so that idea of spending time looking at surgical texts or physician's texts or pathology text gives you much more context and stops this little radiology echo chamber from happening.
Exactly. And that's why even if you don't have access to those non-radiology specialists yourself, you know, actively listening to speakers like Wendy who have done that for you, you know, she speaks to surgeons and listens to surgeons all the time.
Yep.
So you can gain that experience through her. So you want to seek out those kind of educators. And that's the kind of educator that you also want to be yourself, is someone who can bring some experience from other specialists into into your teaching. We probably should wrap this one up though, Gaylor.
Yeah.
We should probably wrap this up, Thor. How can people get in contact with us?
Well, we're at Radiopedia on Twitter and Instagram, as well as at Frank Gaylard and at Dr. Andrew Dixon. And you can email us at podcast@radiopedia.org with any ideas and or feedback or remedies for the man flu.
Yeah. Or record yourself singing happy 60th birthday to Frank and we'll play it on a future episode. And if you want to help support Radiopedia, then you can become a paid supporter via the website or purchase an all-access pass to our online courses and conference. In doing so, you'll be helping us to give free conference and course access to people in 125 low- and middle-income countries. So much promotion in
this. So much. We need a Dixon bobblehead.
The Gaylard figurine. And what else can people do to help us out, Frank?
And you can also help us out by leaving a 5-star review in the podcast app of your choosing.
Excellent. And we'll catch you all again sometime soon, hopefully without man flu next time in the reading room.
This one's a keeper.
Go for it, Thor. Say your line.
Stay rad.
Ooh, right up on the microphone. Get right up there.
Stay rad. That doesn't sound very Queenslander, though, does it?
Give it another try.
No, I'm not going to do it again. We need to get Craig Hacking in here. He can do a good Thor.
No, I want full Byron Bay. Get in there. Pretend you're in a mansion, a huge mansion just outside Byron Bay.
No.
Stay rad. Where's my hammer?
Stay rad. I'm going to go to sleep.
Hope you feel better.